Breaks all you Metsian folk out there. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Metsian Podcast. I hope you've all enjoyed the break. Hope you've enjoyed seeing Pete Alonso win the Home Run Derby back-to-back. Unfortunately, there was not one in 2020, but he probably would have won that one as well. Without further ado, let's go around the horn before bringing on our featured guest, and we're going to start in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn with Mike LeCollant. What's going on, Mike? How you doing?
Hello, Sam. I'm doing well. That was a lot of fun, Pete Alonso. I'm not one for these exhibitions, but he did that with the greatest of ease. What fun.
Well, I think we should get into the format of the Home Run Derby a little bit as to the fact that it's changed a little bit over the years. And I really like the way it was going. So let's go up the highway to Connecticut in Rich Farrago. Rich, what did you think about the Home Run Derby and outside of just Pete Alonso, also the overall entertainment of the thing?
You know, it was great to see Pete win. It's a source of Mets pride, and also I will throw in a plug that he donated 20% of his winnings, 10% to veterans and 10%, I believe, to police officers. So shows you about character right there. But, you know, I've never been big on the Home Run Derby. I always thought it was kind of silly. But I have to say, it's become more entertaining. It's one of those things, at least for me, that hasn't lost entertainment value as it's gone along. It's actually gained entertainment value. So you know what? On a Monday night when there's no baseball, it was fun to watch. Sure, I'm a bit slanted by the fact that Pete won, but I thought it was pretty entertaining, frankly.
Me too, and we'll get a little deeper after talking to our featured guest this evening, and I've known him for a very long time. He's been covering the Mets since he was a child, basically, and he's a digital contributor for SNY. He focuses on the Mets minor leagues through written content and co-hosting Mets Perspective, a bi-weekly video series on SNY.TV and social media. And without further ado, Jacob Resnick, what's going on, man?
Hey, guys. Great to be back on the show. I was trying to remember the last time I was on, and I was pretty sure it was over the summer last year during the height of the pandemic. And I remember having some very, I guess, pretty depressing conversations about, the negotiations between the league and the players and trying to figure out if they were going to play. I don't think we knew at the time. So glad that we're back talking under better circumstances.
That's for sure, and it's crazy just to think that it's been that long, meaning it sounds like we possibly haven't even talked about Steve Cohen, and which I think will let that interweave throughout the entire conversation. But before we get into Mets stuff, let's go shameless plug and slash personal again. You know, for one thing, what was it like being in your junior year? How much? So part of your sophomore year, you were in quarantine, right?
Yeah, the second semester, the spring semester, was it was during our spring break, so it was when everything shut down. So it was we got about half of our second semester of my sophomore year was normal, and then the rest of it was spent at home. And then we were able to come back for the fall this past year for my junior year. We were in person, we were, in the dorms and going into class, but there were the expected restrictions like, you know, masks and limited occupancy in the classrooms, and certainly didn't feel normal, but it was nice to be back after the summer, which was, quieter than it usually is.
So, it's really lucky it's very lucky in any human being that they really know exactly what they want to do as early as you have. And you've been honing in on not just the Mets, but also sports broadcasting in general. And you're going to be going into your senior year at Quinnipiac University this fall. You've been a sports director for Q30 TV, the student-run television station. Tell us a little bit about that. Tell us a bit about your Quinnipiac experience.
Yeah, it's been a great place for me. Everything I was looking for in a school, you know, being from Manhattan, New York City, I didn't want to go too far. I wanted to get out of the city, see some different places, but I didn't want to be too far. So it's a quick train ride to come back home if I need to come back for a weekend. I wanted a place that had Division I sports because, nothing against D2 and D3, but, I love the college sports atmosphere and wanted to go to a school that did have Division I sports. I wanted a place that had a good, highly respected communications program, and I was really, blown away by what Quinnipiac has to offer, and I've had a great time getting to, not only take classes, but do the outside of the classroom stuff, like the, student TV, student broadcasting, journalism, all my friends that I've made through, my close friends I've made through all that kind of stuff. And then this past year, I was afforded the opportunity to move into a more leadership role and be the sports director for the station, which has been awesome. It was a little tough at first with, the pandemic in the fall semester. We didn't have any going on. And then when they did start, we had basketball and hockey during the winter, but they weren't letting anyone into the arena other than the athletes and coaches themselves. So it was tough, but it was a good experience of trying to, make do with what we had. And, looking forward to one more year of trying to get the most out of everything I have.
Well, continued success to you, my friend. We look forward to seeing where your career goes here. And before we get into any Mets stuff, one more time, let's go around the horn. Mike, do you have anything for Jake?
I have plenty. Let's go about it in our conversation. I have a million questions, actually.
And we'll go to Rich.
Nothing. I live in Connecticut, Jacobs. Hope you're enjoying the state. I'm about half an hour from Quinnipiac, down on the beach, and glad to hear you are enjoying it. I think I mentioned to you my daughter's also a graduate of Quinnipiac. My questions for you about baseball will come up in the topics as we get to them. They're very topical of what we plan to talk about. So I'll defer as Mike is.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to go right to Jacob with the Mets. Since it's been so long since we've talked to you, what are your general observations of the first half?
Yeah, I mean, it's been certainly a wild first half. It feels like, multiple seasons crammed into one just with everything that's happened, obviously the season starting with the opening series being canceled in Washington, that feels like it was 5 years ago. And then, it feels like someone like J.D. Davis hasn't played in 3 years, even though it was, the end of April when he went down. And just with all the injuries and all the different guys who have come up and contributed and not contributed and, spent some time on the roster. I mean, guys like Cameron Maben and Jared Eichhoff will be answers to trivia questions, I'm sure, many years from now. It's been fun to watch, the spirit come out of the team because they've been hit really hard with a lot, especially in the injury category, and just to see the different personalities of these guys come together, and it just seems like they really enjoy playing with each other. Certainly, the addition of Francisco Lindor has been huge, and obviously the performance wasn't there in April, but the defense has been stellar the entire time, and I don't think we can really quantify his clubhouse impact. We see it from time to time on the broadcast when they catch him speaking to a pitcher on the mound with his hand on their shoulder. And it's funny because a lot of the times it's a pitcher who's older than him because he's not that old himself. But he's able to calm pitchers down in the dugout. He's always talking to guys and always positive. So, I mean, it's great to see that they're, you know, sitting where they are in first place at the All-Star break for the first time since 2007, which is just unbelievable to think about. You know, that was my second year of following baseball, and to realize that this hasn't happened since then is just wild. So, you know, cautiously optimistic as you have to be about the second half, which I'm sure we'll get into, because we've seen things go wrong before. But yeah, it's been fun, and certainly think this team has a chance if everything continues to click, and the guys who have been struggling are able to turn it around. The guys who've been playing well can keep playing well. I think you know, the stars are aligning, especially considering the state of the National League East right now. The stars are aligning for them to make a run in the postseason.
Mike, I'm going to go with Francisco Lindor there. You know, we've seen some, like, mid-term grades, if you will, and he's been getting Ds, of course. Do you think that's just still kind of where, like, some of the traditionals lie, where they're only looking at the offense? Some of the reasons why we see the Hall of Fame be as it is, where defense doesn't get defense plus, basically, doesn't get as, and you know, maybe it's because it can't get as measured until recently, really, in terms of defense. But what do you think? Do you think that's just it? Some traditionalists still having their way, that seeing that the offensive performance isn't there, that he's not leading on the field, even though he clearly is, as far as, you know, we've talked about?
Maybe not. You know, everyone has their own thing, has their own way of seeing things. I'm a little perturbed about that grade. Maybe perturbed is too strong of a word, but I don't necessarily agree with the D. I know he's underperforming, but I'm okay. Again, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, history has taught us that. Look what happened to Carlos Beltran when he first came to New York. He had a horrible first season, and then what? You know, and he's not the only instance, but he's a very good example. So I'm still giving him the benefit of the doubt. The batting average, you know, some people value it, some people don't. That's where we are with batting average these days. And so far as being a team leader and a locker room leader, you know, he's there. He's vocal. I'm just copacetic. I'm not going to ramble. I'm copacetic with Francisco Lindor. I would have given him, to be fair, C-. I don't concur with D-, plus, or, you know, flat.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative. We're talking grades here. I had been thinking C-plus just because I think he brings so much to the table that it's the offense that really drags it down to the C level anyway. But, you know, to each their own. Rich, let's start with Francisco Lindor, but I also want to loop around to one of his infield mates who will be rejoining the team, I believe, most likely tomorrow, and that's J.D. Davis, who's just been raking at Syracuse.
Yeah, so a couple thoughts on that. With Lindor, you know, obviously the $34 million a year kicks in next year, and if you're evaluating him against a dollar figure, which is wildly inappropriate, then I guess maybe that's where the D came from, which I don't think he can do that. It's not his fault that he's making that kind of money. Somebody's paying him that kind of money. So I would agree with you guys. I would say he's about a C/C+ at this point. First of all, he's trending nicely upward. You know, we can't forget that. You have to be fair there. His defense is very solid. His leadership is good. His energy is good. And with all of that said, and I think we've all kind of touched on this, grading him at all at this point is crazy, right? Because he's going to be here for 10 more seasons. So very, very much tip of the iceberg. And, you know, to be fair, again, if I had to, I would say about a C, definitely trending up, and I expect him to be in the B, solid B range by the end of the season. Now, about J.D. Davis, I mean, that that is going to be an intriguing decision they make about the roster, first of all. That's decision number one. You could do a lot of different things. You know, do you DFA Billy McKinney? Well, you know, that's an outfielder. Jay Davis is an infielder. Do you want to do that? Maybe. I mean, McKinney is not, after his initial, you know, he produced a little bit when they first got him, but he really hasn't been very good. That's an option. Speaking of options, Luis Guillorme has them. Do you send him down? Well, you know, Luis Guillorme is who he is. You know, he's solid defensively. It's hard to look past the fact he has one RBI on the season, and he's really not much of an offensive player. He will draw the walk. He will get the hit. Yes, absolutely. He's not bad. But, you know, he's basically a very skilled defensive replacement spot starter at this point. That's who this guy is. So he has options. You send him down, you could maintain his services in the organization, maybe. Jose Peraza does not have options, so you'd have to DFA him. He will not make it through waivers. Somebody will pick him up. He could play all the positions, probably not as well as Guillorme, but he has a much more potent bat. He has more pop, clearly. So I don't know what they're going to do. It's going to be one of those three guys. And then, all right, so when that's done, now you have Davis on the roster. What are you going to do with him? I mean, VR has been pretty damn good. You know, I mean, you're going to take time away from VR. Maybe you will, but and Mike, I wish I could see your face at this point. I hope they're not going to start playing guys out of position to accommodate JD Davis. Don't put him in left field. No, we don't want that. You know, if he's going to play, I say he should play at third base. How much is up to Rojas? But so, yeah, they have two very complicated decisions to make. First of all, where do you wedge him on the roster? And then where do you play him and who loses playing time? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, considering that, you know, I mean, I was watching a 2019 game at some point, and I think I saw JD Davis in the outfield. So in terms of McKinney, you know, considering I do believe McKinney has options, he has gotten some big hits still of late. But you're right, it's going to be a conundrum. And I'm going to go over to Jacob here with this and the JD Davis element of it. Let's talk minor leagues and trades and where those intersect and when it comes to a position player. Now, we're going to get in the nitty-gritty and talk about all of the different types of needs, but I believe that everybody believes that one of the needs could be a third baseman, just could be a little bit of a more solidifying third baseman, no matter how good everybody has gone. Now, I have heard whispers that they are more determined to solidify the rotation, which I do believe I understand, considering they have been getting production out of third base. However, I do believe, Jacob, that if anything is going to get done with any, you know, experienced third baseman out there, JD Davis is going to be involved in that deal. I don't think you're going to get a deal without it unless you're putting more, maybe the other team is paying some of the remaining contract, I just don't see how it happens without just like a plethora of prospects going the other way. So how do you see, like Rich was saying, in terms of just a roster move, but to me, it even brings up the trade deadline conundrum and the fact that I think that if the Mets do go the route of getting somebody like, let's say, a Chris Bryant or a Josh Donaldson, JD Davis is going to be included.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I agree with the point that that you brought up in the middle of all that, that, you know, the addition of a bat, you know, if you're going to admit, you know, you being the organization, the organization is going to admit that they're going to have to give up something to bolster their team down the stretch, whether that be prospects or a major leaguer like JD Davis or spend money to take on someone's contract, you know, then I would rather that be in the for a pitcher in the rotation or, you know, multiple relievers or whatnot, rather than a hitter, because the pure talent level in the lineup is too good to not come around at some point this season. compared to their pitching depth right now, which is physically non-existent. So, you know, I don't really see the point in spending the capital on someone like, you know, a Donaldson or Chris Bryant. I'd love to have those players. I just don't see it as the more pressing need. As far as the roster goes, I mean, you know, it's tough. I don't know if I've seen a more polarizing player recently on, you know, in the Mets social media, Twitter fan sphere than JD, because you got half of the fans who would take a bullet for him. You got half of the fans who, you know, cringe every time he steps onto a baseball field. You know, I don't think he's at the Conforto McNeil level where they come back off the injured list and he has a guaranteed spot in the lineup every single day. I think you play him when the matchups are favorable for, you know, however many days a week that might be. And if not, you know, I've said this going back to, you know, last year, 2019, if he doesn't start for you, he's one of the more valuable bench bats in the league. And there's a ton of value to that. And having someone like VR in the starting lineup gives you better defense and speed compared to Davis, and is not really a slouch with the bat either. And then to be able to bring Davis off the bench to, you know, face the tough lefty in the late innings or whatever is pretty valuable. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do. You know, I think I would put a wager on the immediate roster move being DFAing Jared Eichhoff, who's still on the roster for some reason. But since the interesting thing is Davis is on the 60-day injured list right now, they moved him there to create a 40-man spot, and the 40-man is full now, so they're going to bring him back on. They're going to have to kick someone off, and DFA and Eichhoff would accomplish you know, both things, getting Davis on the active roster and the 40-man roster. Going forward, you know, I mean, they are going to need a fifth starter at some point, whether that's, you know, Carlos Carrasco or someone else, and whenever he's ready to come back. So, you know, at that point, then, you know, you look at, you know, maybe cutting McKinney or sending Guillorme down. But I don't expect it to be anything, you know, earth-shattering like, you know, DFAing Peraza or something like that. So,
yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, Mike. We've brought up a lot of different stuff, you know, so you can run with it where you will. But I will start with I don't want Guillorme anywhere away from this team. I do think he would have value as depth down below, but I like what he provides, you know, and he just seems to continue to make contact outside of how great his defense is. Hey, Mike, you there?
I beg forgiveness. I was on mute. I'm here.
Oh, no. Hey. Live entertainment, everybody. Mike,
sorry about that.
You did hear me, correct?
Yes, I did. I'll just throw this out there. By the way, Carlos Carrasco, he pitched two scoreless innings for Brooklyn. Retired the side in order in the first. Allowed one hit, struck out two, seven batters faced, 27 pitches, 17 for strikes. So hopefully help is on the way. You know, Guillorme, that's a tough call, Sam. It really is. You know, I will let the games play themselves out and see who matters most. But, Jacob, I will throw this at you. Should we be turning a blind eye to third base and just stick it out with VR and Davis? And I say that because Mark Vientos, you know, he's doing pretty well for Binghamton. Brett Beatty just got promoted. And, Rich, you know, you brought up playing out of position. You know, Brett Beatty was playing third base for the Cyclones, and now he's playing left field for Binghamton. That's driving me nuts. But I'll throw it back to you, Jacob. Should we throw a blind eye to third base?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, if you're going to acquire someone like a Chris Bryant, then that's, you know, you're acquiring him with just this rest of the year on his contract, and you're not committing anything to the long term. But yeah, I mean, they do have a couple of, you know, blue chippers in the minors. And, if you kind of get through, the interim between when, you know, the current time and when they're ready, I think, you know, they'll be able to come up and contribute probably immediately, because, you know, I'm pretty high on both of those guys.
And what do you make about this Beatty in left field for Binghamton?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, especially tonight in particular, because Vientos was hit by a pitch last night and left the game. He's out of the lineup again tonight. So with Vientos being out and not playing third base, Beatty's still playing left field. Listen, I don't I mean, it's making me tear my hair out per se, because I have nothing against trying to make guys more versatile, and I think he's, you know, athletic enough to handle it, but it is kind of weird. It just, in the way they're doing it, kind of, you know, mid-season, just trying to, you know, work it out. I mean, it's like, I mean, we saw it with J.D. Davis trying to learn outfield in the middle of the 2019 season, and we saw how that went. So it's just kind of odd the way they've gone about it. But I don't think really there's much to read into in terms of, you know, any earth-shattering developments, I guess.
Take it back,
thanks,
Sam.
Mike. Let's go. Yeah, I appreciate it. Let's go right into that. Let's go right into some of this minor league stuff. Let's talk about the future. First of all, tell us about Brett Beatty, Francisco Alvarez, and anybody else that I have missed in Brooklyn this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alvarez is the guy to start with. He's been just absolutely everything everyone hoped coming into the season. You know, he was signed the out of the international market from Venezuela a couple years ago, and only got up to Kingsport in 2019, obviously no season in 2020. So we've been hearing about him for a while and just haven't really gotten to see him, because, you know, the low rookie ball levels are not, you know, there's no public video or anything like that. So, you know, and then he started the year at St. Lucie, was just absolutely destroying that league. He's only 19 years old, and he was absolutely beating up on that league, and then got the quick promotion to Brooklyn. I mean, he's, you know, what a future all-star catcher looks like in the minor leagues. Obviously, there's no guarantee he becomes that, and I've been extremely cautious in talking to people about him, that, you know, the directions that a young teenage minor league catcher, the directions in which his career could go before he reaches the major leagues, or if he reaches the major leagues, is about a million different directions. Gary Sanchez was talked about for years with the Yankees as, you know, the future great catcher, all-star catcher, and it even took him 7 or 8 years to climb the levels and get to the minor leagues. So, I mean, this is as good as it gets, but don't assume that he's going to come up, you know, in September or early next year and just be that guy, you know, the best catcher since Mike Piazza when he comes up, because it's probably going to take some time. But he's been really great to watch, and, you know, he's a really good kid as well. Beatty, you mentioned, we talked a little bit about, got the bump up to Binghamton. He was in the futures game with Alvarez, and he's great. I mean, he's got the hit tool. He's got unbelievable power. Just the way he is able to, I think, you know, 5 of his 7 home runs this year have been to the opposite field. So he's able to muscle balls out the other way. And, you know, he has a really strong arm at third base and works really hard. So he's there, and, you know, I think him being a shiny new toy, to put it one way, has been, you know, kind of tough for Mark Vientos, because he's another big third base prospect that the Mets have, and People started to forget about him to start the year when Brett Beatty was lighting the world on fire with Brooklyn, and then Vientos went on a tear of his own in Binghamton in June, was, you know, absolutely smoking the ball, hit 9 home runs, his OPS was over 1.1, and, you know, unfortunately last night got hit in the hand, like I mentioned before, so I hope everything's okay there, but it's going to be fun to see what they end up doing with those guys. They trade one. I really don't think they are planning on trading any of these guys. Ronnie Mauricio is the other top guy, shortstop at Brooklyn. He's had a rough go of it. You know, the batting average hasn't been there. You know, his pitch recognition skills have been kind of tough to watch. He can't really pick up spin that well. But the big thing was his power, which had been talked about for years, you know, dating back to when the Mets spent a lot of money to sign him at the Dominican Republic. His power just hasn't showed up in games yet, and it has so far. I think he's hit 9 home runs, switch hitter, so he can do it from both sides. So, you know, you just hope the back-to-ball skills get there for him, and I think it will. You just kind of have to be patient, but people are starting to sour on him. I don't really agree with that. So, you know, the top of this organization is fantastic. You know, other guys, J.P. Ginn, Pete Armstrong, Matt Allen, you know, those last two guys are hurt and are going to miss the rest of the year. But when they come back, they're fantastic guys to watch as well. And add all of that to Kumar Rocker, who the Mets just took in the first round, 10th overall. He's a potential major league starter as well. So it's fun. You know, after the first 7 or 8 guys in the system, it gets pretty bad pretty quickly. But those guys should give Mets fans a lot to be super excited about for the next few years.
That is for sure. I'm going to leave the Kumar Rocker question for when we loop back around to Mike. But before I get to Rich, can you remind me how old is Francisco Alvarez?
He's 19. He'll be 19 for all of this season. Pretty sure his birthday is in November, November or December. So yeah, it's so impressive how he handles himself. I mean, you know, I've seen his teenageness come out at some times. You know, he doesn't, or you know, he has the tendency to kind of, you know, forget where he is, get a little angry on the field sometimes, but you know, he's special, all sides of the ball.
And he didn't get promoted, correct? He's still in Brooklyn, and is the plan to keep him there?
Yeah, he's still in Brooklyn. He got bumped up there from St. Lucie, and I'm assuming they'll keep him there. I mean, you know, the fact that he's 19, there's no reason to rush him. So yeah, he should be in Brooklyn the rest of the year. Maybe a little cameo at the end of the year in Binghamton, but not other than that.
Okay. You are listening to the Metsian Podcast, and Rich, before I pass it on to you to ask whatever minor league questions you want for Jacob, I will say this. I just, when we're talking about Brett Beatty getting the call up, I just see him Indiana Jones style traveling by map, and where you don't go out of the New York State region every time you have to get bumped up. Other than St. Lucie, which, you know, just it's naturally, it's where the spring training home's been for a long time. You just climb up there, you go to Brooklyn, and then Binghamton, Syracuse, back to New York. I like that so much better. It's so refreshing.
Yeah. I mean, growing up, you know, AAA was in Norfolk. And, you know, which isn't terrible. I mean, it was awful when it was in Vegas, right? Because if you had an urgent need, you had somebody who was 5 hours away by flight. But it's great that everything's right in the same state and everybody can move around easily. So that is great. And Jacob, you know, where I would ask you to take us next would be here. I admit, you know, I'm not as close to the draft as maybe I should be. Like, I was following it on Twitter and on, you know, some of your stuff, of course, reading your stuff. So here's what I know, and I'm going to assume that a lot of Met fans might be where I am with it. So, great, they drafted Rocker. I read up on him, and, you know, you see these projections that he could probably pitch in the major leagues at the end of the season, which obviously is pie in the sky. But everybody's saying he's a steal. You know, they got him at 10. That's great. Okay. If you could walk us through, you know, I'm not asking to laboriously go through every other player they drafted, but the positions they drafted for and your overall assessment of their draft, I'd be fascinated to hear that if you could.
Yeah, I mean, it's not dissimilar to a couple of years ago, 2019, I think it was, where they were able to pick up Matt Allen in the third round. They were able to negotiate with him and navigate the signability waters and kind of tailor their entire draft around picking him up. And obviously Brett Beatty was there as well, but the feeling coming out of that was, you know, this is the Matt Allen draft, and if we hit on Matt Allen, then it was a good draft. So as much as you're probably going to be tired of hearing about Kumar Rocker, you know, that's what this is. If they're able to turn him into a good major league starter, then this draft was a success. Not to say they didn't pick up some other interesting guys as well. You know, they went with Calvin Ziegler in the second round, a pitcher who's originally from Canada, pitched high school in Florida this past year. Kind of a guy who I think was a little under-scouted just because of the situation with the pandemic and him having to kind of move around a bit. But the Mets have really good scouts, especially in Florida, who were able to see him. And, they had him as a potential first-round pick on their board. And then following him, the third-rounder, Dominic Hamill, is I think, potentially the quickest to the major leagues guy in this draft, starting pitcher out of Dallas Baptist, who just has kind of the complete makeup of a starting pitcher, and the metrics on his pitches are kind of what everyone's talking about with him, you know, spin and movement, vertical movement on his fastball and curveball, all that kind of stuff. And kind of the emblematic of what the Mets are trying to do with their drafts now. And, after that, they kind of went with, you know, what you would expect from the later round college guys who have played really well in major conferences, like their fourth rounder, JT Schwartz out of UCLA, Mike Vazel in the eighth round, and another guy is pretty interesting, could have been a first-round pick out of high school a couple of years ago. Rowdy Jordan in the 11th round out of Mississippi State, kind of that Jake Mangum ilk, you know, those grinder guys that they have down there in Mississippi. And a couple guys from Fairfield, actually, which I'm sure is interesting to you as a Connecticut guy and myself having seen them play plenty of times. So, no one with kind of a super high ceiling upside later in the draft. And I think, you know, the entire point of what they were attempting to do is just, you know, start to build the depth. Because like I mentioned, after the first six, seven, eight, now it's more like seven, eight, nine guys in the system, it drops off super quickly. And, they've had to sign 11 guys out of Indy Ball this year already just to make starts in AAA and AA. And it's kind of gone as you would expect. So, they need to add pitchers into the system, homegrown pitchers, and you hope with the organization becoming a little more analytically minded under Steve Cohen now that they'll be able to turn some of these guys with maybe a lower ceiling in the scouting world into potential, you know, depth pieces down the line.
Thank you. And so overall, I heard a lot of pitchers. Did they target a particular position player, like a third base, shortstop? Well, I think shortstop would be the last thing they would look for. But any particular trend jump out to you, Jacob? Like, was it outfield or anything among position players?
I wouldn't say there was a trend, really. I mean, they only took eight. They took, I think, three outfielders and three shortstops and a first baseman and a catcher. So, I think they were looking for athleticism, you know, guys who can play the field well in addition to swing it a little bit. Wyatt Young they took in the 15th round out of Pepperdine is a 5'7" shortstop, but he plays well above his height. He is a real good defensive and contact oriented guy, and the Mets were talking about really making sure they wanted to get him, even though he was a later round pick. So not really any trends there, and I think it's going to be a little tough with these guys to fit in, just because of the setup of the minor leagues now, where you don't have the short season level to bridge the gap between the complex and low A. So it'll be interesting to see where these guys kind of start their career, if it's this season at all. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of guys just shut it down.
Thank you.
And before I pass it on to Mike, Jacob, it might be an ignorant thing to say, or it might be the truth, but let me ask you what you think. Is college baseball the most popular it's ever been?
Good question. I think, obviously I can't speak to what the popularity level was, going back a couple of decades, but it's great to see how big it is now. I mean, just with the coverage it gets, and the College World Series in particular, and the rest of the tournament gets a lot of eyeballs on it from people who don't necessarily follow it during the rest of the year. And I've had a little bit different introduction to it, and just having that small conference background with watching Quinnipiac on a small field that doesn't get a lot of love, and it's a little bit of a different atmosphere than the teams that go to Omaha every year for the World Series. It's a fun kind of environment situation going on, and you got someone like Kumar Rocker, who's pitched on the biggest stage in college baseball, pitching at Vanderbilt and in the College World Series twice. He threw a no hitter there as a freshman. I think he's very uniquely suited to potentially pitch in New York one day.
It's quite the baseball name for sure. Mike, take it away. I know I think Kumar Rocker is the perfect segue.
Absolutely. Jacob, take us through the money exchange. He signed a $6 million bonus. What does that really mean for the benefit of the people listening insofar as slotting and whatnot?
Yeah, well, each draft slot position pick from the first round through the 10th round has a slot value assigned to it, and that's kind of weird. I mean, it just as a concept, it's like it's not really a recommendation. It's more just like what, because each team has a total pool that they're allowed to spend on their draft picks in the first 10 rounds, and I guess it's kind of divided up by each selection. So obviously the first round pick is going to have a much bigger slot value than the 9th round pick or the 10th round pick. So the slot value for the 10th overall pick, which is where they took Kumar Rocker, is about $4.7 million, $4.74. But obviously it was reported that he's going to get a signing bonus of $6 million, and that's significantly more in the scope of trying to fit everyone under budget. So if you go as much over as they are to sign Rocker, that's less money than you can spend on the other draft picks. And, every guy who's taken in the first round, it's pretty much understood that they're being taken with their bonus demands and their signability is pretty much understood by the teams when they take him. So the Mets knew that they were going to have to go over to sign Rocker. And I think it's a little bit of a weird situation where, the agent being Scott Boras, he's able to have those pre-draft conversations with the Mets and say, listen, we want Kumar to sign with you guys. You guys can take him. But you're going to have to spend this much money. The Mets say, yeah, we'll give it to you. So then Scott Boras can tell all nine teams in front of the Mets that we're not going to sign with you. So the Mets are making a significant investment in Kumar, and you know, kind of look at the types of players they took in the other later rounds. You know, rounds 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 are guys who have slot values around 150K, 200K, up to even, you know, 500,000 for the fourth rounder. You know, those guys are not going to get close to that money. So it's a bit of a chess game in terms of trying to make sure all the pieces fit and get the money to work. And, you know, you're allowed to go over your pool by 5% before you lose future draft picks, and that's the worst case scenario. So they'll get it done. It'll be interesting to see what happens, especially considering, you know, Tommy Tanis, the Mets, you know, scouting, VP of scouting, said that they didn't really take any of those guys with an eye on saving a bunch of money. So in the past, some guys they've taken in those middle rounds, they've gotten a signing bonus as low as literally $1,000, which compared to their slot value is minuscule. So, you know, they're going to make under slot, but probably only by maybe 100K, 150K. To make sure Rocker's able to fit in there.
And this next point is actually a good one. It was sent in to us on Twitter by a Big Red Ruckus, and this is for the room. But I'll start with you, Jacob. We have to think about where this organization was and where it is presently. This organization effectively ruined their relationship with Norfolk, and they were banished to New Orleans. And then, you know, they managed to get into Buffalo, but that relationship was also ruined. And again, they got banished far away in Las Vegas. The minor league system was in turmoil under the Wilpons. So, you know, that's an open-ended question, and I'll start with you. Not necessarily a question, but a statement, but I'll nevertheless start with you, Jacob.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of that kind of behind-the-scenes stuff was a little before my time of being super in tune to this stuff, but, you know, I have heard about some of that stuff with Norfolk and Buffalo, and I mean, I guess it should be noted that they have the long-term deal, or it's not even a deal. They own Syracuse now, and all of that did happen under the Wilpons, so I guess that was their last good deed, one of not many that they imparted on the organization. But, you know, I think they are in a good spot now with, I mean, it goes back to Sam, which you were saying before with the layout, and it's very ideal compared to, we didn't even mention Las Vegas. So that was probably the worst possible situation that any East Coast team could be in, having a minor league, or not just a minor league team, your AAA team. In on the West Coast. So, you know, they're able to get out of there. They have the short drive from Brooklyn to Binghamton to Syracuse and then up to the majors. So it's a good spot. And I think all of the communities that have these teams are very appreciative.
Take it away, host.
That they are. Thank you. Yeah, that they are, especially Brooklyn. Let's be honest there. Jacob, let me ask you this before we go anywhere else outside of the minor leagues. Have you been out to Brooklyn this year? And what has it been like not only just to have baseball back where people can come, but also being a high A team? The way the whole thing is now operating.
Yeah, I wasn't able to get to one game earlier this year. It was actually Francisco Alvarez's Brooklyn debut back at the end of May. So I haven't been able to get up there as much as I would like to and as much as I have in previous years. But, yeah, I think everyone's super excited to be back and, you know, specifically the employees of the teams, you know, people who are seasonal employees for the most part who rely on there being baseball every summer to not just have a source of income, but have a fun thing to do every night during the season. So everyone's, you know, happy to have the team back. And it's funny you mentioned that. I didn't really notice anything that stood out that made me say, yeah, this is high A baseball now compared to the short season team that they had before, you know, especially with cutting out levels like they did. I think the talent level is not exactly the same at each level as it was pre-pandemic. So still, you know, minor leaguers, young guys, they still make errors on the field. They still walk three guys an inning and lose the strike zone sometimes and don't hit the cutoff, man. So, yeah, I didn't really notice any big differences in that arena.
I'll pass it over to Mike, and before we go anywhere, Mike, have you noticed anything different? I know you've been out there.
I have. I've noticed a stark increase in power, home runs per game. That was uncommon in the New York Penn League. It was a pitcher's league. Now that they're a full season, you know, high A level, they've elevated, and the power has elevated as such. So that's the biggest difference I've noticed from New York Penn League short season to high A. More home runs by everybody, all teams, all competitions.
Right. Well, interesting. And Mike, before I go anywhere, you know, you had quite the list of the things that you think we should talk about. So looking at it myself, I'm going to pass it on to you to go wherever you want to go next from the topics that you that we discussed pregame.
How about we have a little bit of fun? We always talk about get this guy, get that player, get this one, acquire that one. What if the Mets would have signed George Springer and Trevor Bauer? Oh, my goodness. Rich.
Oh, my goodness is right. I mean, George Springer can't stay on the field, and Trevor Bauer is public enemy number one. So, yeah, I mean, and when you think about it, right, you think about Taijuan Walker, who a lot of people said, oh, you know, the Mets, they got X out of Bauer. The Dodgers outbid them or whatever. Maybe Bauer wanted to play in L.A., where he's from, all of that. And the Mets went for Taijuan Walker. And a lot of people were saying, you know, that that's like settling in a big way. You know, Walker isn't that good. Why was he still available in the middle of February? Well, you know, our guy's an all-star, and he's 7-3, I think. And he has an ERA of 2.50. So I think I'll take that. And it's a wonderful story with Taijuan Walker, you know, how he is doing so incredibly well. And then with Springer, you know, I wanted Springer on the Mets. I'm not going to lie about that. I definitely thought he'd be a great fit, but, you know, sometimes the best moves are the ones you don't make, right? And with Springer, he's not able to stay on the field in Toronto, and the Mets have done just fine. You know, we've had the dramatics of Kevin Pillar. Brandon Nimmo, to me, has become a major league center fielder. I was very down on his center field abilities before the season, but although he's missed a significant amount of time, he looks very comfortable out there. The Mets have, and when he wasn't there, they pieced it together well. So, you know, I don't think you would have found five Met fans anywhere who would have told you that the Mets would be just fine in those positions, right? They would be fine with the guy they got essentially instead of Bauer, and that center field would be fine, and actually they'd be much better off without Springer. Not many people would have taken that bet, but that's the way it's played out.
Very true, and I want to go down the Brandon Nimmo route. That's a great point about how much better he's been as a center fielder. And I'm looking up right now. I'm a little behind, but I want to just remind myself as to how old he is. Where? There we go.
He's 29.
Age 28. So my question for you, and I'll start with you, Jacob, is from what you've seen from Brandon Nimmo, and obviously, unfortunately, that he's also had a bit of the injury bug over the time, but, you know, thinking back to when they drafted him, he was somebody that, you know, he was right out, I believe he was right out of high school, basically, but there was no high school baseball that they could fall back on. It was American Legion that he had been playing, and they thought that they were drafting very high. So as good as Brandon Nimmo has been, we really could see him get better, right, Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, I think his ceiling is not, he hasn't reached the ceiling yet is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, I agree with you. And he's hitting that peak of his prime. He's getting there, but he's not, I don't think he's at the surface yet. I mean, he's, you know, a guy who Mets fans have known for a long time, like you said, going back to when they drafted him. And he had a tough go of it in the minor leagues and really had to kind of grind to get through some rough patches. And he's an easy guy to root for on the field, and off the field maybe a little different considering, you know, certain aspects of various things that we could talk about or not talk about. But, you know, he's a Major League Baseball player, and he showed it in 2018 when he really had the first opportunity to be an everyday guy and was just absolutely fantastic. Had a, you know, one of the best on base percentages in the National League. And unfortunately, the injuries and the shortened season have hurt him. But he's still performed. He's always performed when he's on the field since becoming a full-time player. And you mentioned his defense. It's been very good compared to where he had been, especially a year ago in 2020. He was close to unwatchable out there. And he's absolutely flipped the script this year. So good on him. I think, you know, it's certainly worth talking about at some point, you know, an extension with him. Haven't really heard that discussed too much because he's not yet at the free agency walk year, but he will be, I'm pretty sure, next year. Yeah. So at some point, the Mets are going to want to have those discussions with him. You know, he's not the type of guy who I think his skills are going to absolutely plummet, you know, with age. You know, he's got a keen eye and he makes contact with the ball. I think he'll be good for quite a few years.
If I may add to that, Sam, before you take it back, in terms of outs above average, you're right in the way you said it, Jacob. You know, he was a little tough to watch in center field last year with his outs above average being -4 in 2020. Well, he's flipped that script, as you said, to a +2 in center field in 2021. That's an enormous difference. That's a 6-run above average, outs above average, 6 outs above average difference. And that is a huge jump. So the numbers back him up. You know, it's just not perception that he seems to be better out there. Statistically, he is significantly better in center field. And that really was the only thing with him. You know, he of course, he gets on base. He's an on-base machine. He actually has 30 – he's number 34 in Major League Baseball for sprint speed, so he obviously can move around. So there were never any questions on any of that stuff. I think it was always about, is he a center fielder? And the numbers would back up that he has become a good center fielder.
You know, Rich, what I love about everything you just said was that it was all about baseball. And that's where I'm going to go to you next, Rich, is that and I'm going to tie Trevor Bauer in with this because this is basically when it comes down to the politics. I don't really talk about what my politics are on here. I'm sure if anybody has been listening over the years, they can piece it together at certain points. But one of the things I don't care about is whatever Brandon Nimmo does. The only thing I care about is whether Brandon Nimmo votes with a bat in his hand while taking it to center field, while taking the ball to center field. That's the only thing I care about, as well as bringing balls back from the center field wall, as he did that other day. Unfortunately, the Mets didn't win that day. Weird trend the Mets have with great catches during losses. But anyway, Rich, when we're talking about Trevor Bauer, I don't even know what Trevor Bauer's politics are. I'm sure at some point in all the videos that Trevor Bauer has made over the years, he has mentioned his politics. But right now, you know, but one of the things that, like, the idea that Brandon Nimmo is a Wyoming country boy, excuse me, in the city was used as a lotto commercial, you know, where he's doing all these fake, you know, nice boy curses. You know, so
wouldn't you just so much, unless you find out that he was storming the Capitol on January 6th, wouldn't you much rather have Brandon Nimmo right now than whatever's going on with Trevor Bauer?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's, he's one reason why a lot of fans are saying, myself included, this is a fun team. It's the kind of team you want to root for. You know, Lindor's a great guy, seemingly. You know, we obviously don't know these people personally, but Mr. Smile, right? Well, Brandon Nimmo, Mr. Smile number two. Good, wholesome guy. You know, the whole thing with the Cookie Club from a couple of years ago, you know, those guys are largely still here. You know, J.D. Davis will be back. And Pete Alonso donating his money from the Home Run Derby, when he donated the money from the cleats to the 9/11 thing. You know, this is a team that it's certainly not the Bad Boys. It's not the 86 Mets. You know, they have a pretty good reputation as being good guys on and off the field. They're easy to root for. You know, we root for them anyway, of course, but they're easy to root for because of that. You haven't seen a lot of staining on this team from off the field stuff. In fact, none that I could think of. You know, you had the one incident with McNeil and Lindor, of course, but that was on the field and it was quickly rectified. They've had their fun with the whole Donnie Stevenson thing. So yeah, you know, there's a lot to this team to like. And one of the things would be that they've kept their noses clean. You know, they're fun. They've kept their noses clean. There are no big scandals around them at this point. Off the field scandals, like, you know, the Dodgers have and stuff like that. So, you know, it all comes together. They're winning on the field. They're fun to be a fan of, and they're seemingly good guys. So, yeah, it's a good picture.
Mike, I'll send it back to you with this, but the Dodgers have oddly been a better team since they all unfollowed Trevor Bauer on Instagram.
You muted again.
Did we lose Mike?
Yes, I did. I apologize. I beg forgiveness.
I just thought my joke didn't land. That's all.
You know what? I've never before ever muted during the podcast. Last podcast I started, and I'm doing it this podcast, and I'm doing a terrible job, aren't I? Anyway, let me pick up where you left off. I'm looking on Twitter as we speak. About 9 hours ago, Bill Plaschke of the LA Times, he tweeted, "It would be enormously expensive and legally difficult, but Dodgers need to cut Trevor Bauer right now." So I need not say anything.
And I beg you, take us wherever else you want to go on that list you made for us.
All right, let's talk Mets. You know, what's going on presently and what's about to transpire over the next couple of days. We've got a 6-game road trip coming up versus Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. Unlike the previous series with Pittsburgh, you know, where we split 2-2, we need to do better this time, please. Pirates, bottom feeder, Central Division, do better. Cincinnati, you know, if they take 2 out of 3, cool. I'd also like to bring up, we have games against the LA Dodgers, San Francisco Giants, and the San Diego Padres. Now, the Padres, we've played already. We have yet to play the Dodgers and the Giants, I believe. We have 7 games against the Dodgers and 6 games coming up against the Giants in August, the dog days of summer. 13 games right there, I think, can make or break this season. What say you guys?
So I'm going to start with you, Jacob. And before we get into August, let's talk Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. Yes, you know, Pittsburgh's been playing better, but the Mets, you know, need not have any excuses here. They need to beat up on Pittsburgh. Cincinnati is 4 games behind Milwaukee right now, having completely leapfrogged Chicago, who's just in a free fall. You know, where are you on this upcoming schedule for the Mets? Did we lose Jacob too?
Dun dun dun.
Oh, dun dun dun. Hold on. Have somebody. Yeah, we did you hear my question, sir?
Yeah, it's me.
Hey, Jacob.
Can you hear me now?
Hey. Yes, yes. We can hear you now. Did you hear all of my question, any of my question, none of my question?
I think I had gotten disconnected during the discussion, but I hopped back in. So, no, I did hear what you were talking about. The schedule coming up is going to be interesting, and I had the Dodgers and Giants games ticked off as something I was going to want to bring up as well, and not just 13 games against those two teams, but 13 games in a row in the middle of August. So certainly there are other opponents mixed in there that if the Mets are legit, they should beat. Like Pittsburgh, they need a sweep coming out of the break to feel comfortable, considering how the previous series against them went, and then obviously the Reds and teams like the Marlins and Phillies and Nationals are solid, but they're below them. They should feel like they're better than them going into those series, and need that kind of confidence. And then it's that stretch against the Dodgers and Giants that will 100% make or break their season. I totally agree with that. Those are the teams that, they could be playing against for the right to go to the World Series. It could end up that way if everything breaks right. So they need to show that they're of that level. And I think the other interesting thing to bring up is the little, news that broke while we were on the air here is the Braves making a move for Jock Peterson, trading for him from the Cubs. And obviously Jock Peterson's not going to completely turn their season around, but he's a very legitimate power bat that they can add to their lineup, especially now with Ronald Acuna out for the rest of the year, which is, just brutal. The reporting now is that the other teams in the NL East believe that they should be buyers because the Mets are showing, I think the quote that someone reported was showing their vulnerability. So I think the big question that I guess I can pose to you guys is how comfortable should the Mets feel, forget the Dodgers and Giants and the landscape of Major League Baseball, how comfortable should the Mets feel within their own division right now?
Good question. Obviously, that was just not a game you want to give up. But they had some good vibes with this All-Star game, with the Home Run Derby. What say you, Rich? Go ahead with how Jacob posed it.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, comfortable, you never can be comfortable, to use that word, because until you're mathematically the division champion. But with that said, if the Mets don't win this division, shame on them for a couple of reasons. Number one, they have the lead, they've hit the All-Star break with a four-game lead in the loss column. Okay. If you look at the Mets roster when healthy, which they're about to be, against the rosters of the rest of the National League East, I you guys tell me if you disagree, I think the Mets have the best roster in the division, and they have the lead. So they should win it, and if they don't, it will be a disappointment at this point. You look at the Braves, they're a flawed team. Their bullpen is bad. Their starting rotation isn't very good either. And, granted, you have your Charlie Morton, your Max Fried, but they don't have Soroka, and they're reaching for starters. Their bullpen, like I said, has been bad. And with Acuna out, like Jacob said, Jock Peterson, nice player, not Acuna. So, and to me, after Freddie Freeman, that lineup doesn't scare me. After Albies, I should say. So you have Freeman and Albies. I don't think Austin Riley, he can hit the ball at the ballpark and stuff like that. But the rest of that lineup is pretty pedestrian. Phillies, their bullpen will kill them. They have very good starting pitching. Wheeler, Nola, absolutely. And even Eflin. But their bullpen is a disaster. Their offense is inconsistent. So you have that. The Nationals, I think they rode a hot Kyle Schwarber to get themselves in the conversation, and I think they will fade away. They're even talking about – well, they're not talking about it, but – the reporters and such, the media talking about them being sellers, actually, maybe looking to move Scherzer. So that tells you where they are. So, again, sitting here on July 15th, if we're having this conversation October 3rd and the Mets did not win the division, yeah, damn right I'm going to be disappointed. They should win this division. They should have won in 07. They should have won in 08. So should's a big word. But I do think that with where they are, what they have, and Sandy and Zach Scott will probably bring in some chips at the end of the month, I think they really should win this division. I'm confident as I can be on July 15th.
And I will lead it back to you, Mike, and pose, what is the biggest difference that you see in 2021 so far between this and 2007-2008?
You read my mind, Sam. I was going to be an idiot about it. Insofar as the rest of the division, there's the 51 Giants, there's the 78 Yankees. Insofar as the Mets, as you say, Sam, and you so eloquently stole from me, 2007 and 2008. What's it going to be? That's the fun part. We're going to see it play out. You know, there's nothing stopping the Braves or the Phillies or even Washington from going on, a hot streak, a very lengthy one at that, having a very good month. One of those months that somebody goes 20-7. And if the Mets are a 500, well, what happens next? So it's going to be interesting. As Rich has been saying, as Sam, you've been saying, as I've been saying, I think the laws of averages say that Conforto, Alonso, Dom Smith are going to pick it up and support this pitching staff. That's my hope. I've been filled with positive vibes all season. I'm not about to start now, I have no compunction being the pessimist,
I know that's for sure, man. I mean, I remember your face as that ball went over, Dom Smith's bat in 2019. That was the last time you and I were able to take a game in together, Mike. And I know that you, the way you looked at me was almost like you knew it all along. And you were definitely not a pessimist. you're a pragmatist, though. That is for sure. Even if you are what do they call it? Cockeyed optimist, as the song goes.
My wife calls me the absent-minded professor. So I appreciate all the monikers.
That was in my era. That was Robin Williams. But who was the? That was the Jerry Lewis, right? Was the original one? Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody?
Yeah.
This is an interesting schedule that you were talking about, Mike. But I want to talk about, before getting a little bit deeper into August, I'm looking at this 5-game Braves series. And I'll start with you, Jacob, here. One of the things, I like the fact that the Mets are in first place, 3.5 games ahead to their closest competitor, with Ronald Acuna generally in the lineup. Unfortunately, that was just atrocious. And it doesn't matter what happens to, the competition. You want to beat the competition, as far as I'm concerned. You want to beat the competition with everybody on the field. This year, it hasn't just been a Mets thing. It's been a league-wide thing. Do you think that has something to do with 2020, even though obviously some of these are freak injuries?
Yeah, I think there's certainly an element of that, and guys were interrupted in a way that they have not been their entire lives, and their bodies have made adjustments and have required much more in terms of preparation and care than they have in the past. It's just been unfortunate that it's hit the entire league the way it has. But this is why you build depth in the offseason to try to plug the gaps when you need filling of those holes.
Exactly, and like you said, they traded for Jock Peterson, so it's going to be interesting. Looking at this August, like you were all saying, this is make or break. Basically with the arguably, the most crucial sandwich between games with the Marlins. And we all know, regardless, doesn't matter where the Marlins are, doesn't matter where they are in the standings, they're always going to be that pesky fish at the bottom or somewhere near the top of the division. So it's going to be interesting to see the way this entire thing lies. I think the only other place to go, Mike, next is the black jerseys returning July 30th. Take it away. I'll give you first dibs on those. How we doing? Oh, man.
Damn, I did it again. I'm sorry.
that's okay.
I'm so sorry. No more. I'm done with mute. Anyway, experiment over. Put me back on track. I'm sorry. Oh, the black jerseys. I'm sorry. Everybody knows I'm not a big fan of them. I'll buy them. I'll wear them. Just don't want to see the team in them. Anyway, that being said, it's not lost upon me that the Mets won the National League Championship in 2000 wearing that jersey, and it's not lost upon me that they won the NL East in 2006 wearing that jersey in September. So there's nostalgia behind that jersey, and for those who like the jersey, have at it, enjoy yourselves, and I'll just sit idly by until they put their regular pinstripe blue and orange.
I hear that, and for me, I do think it. I don't know whether I completely love it. I love it from if you're going to have the home version, you got to have the road version. And I hated the fact that when they were wearing the blacks at the tail end of its tenure on the road, they weren't wearing the New York black. They were wearing the Mets black, and that just never made any sense to me. Even if, Metropolitan is very New York, it's still, you got to be wearing, this isn't a Phillies thing. You still have to be wearing New York across the chest. So I'll go to you, Jacob. You came at the tail end of the black jerseys as well. They identify less with 2006 and 2007 and 2008. Than they do with the late 90s, early 2000s. However, at the same time, there are some memories in those years in the black jerseys. What say you, Jacob?
Can you guys hear me? Because I had disconnected again, but I'm back.
Yeah, no, we got you. We got you. I made sure to unmute you, sir.
Okay, perfect. I've never really had any strong feelings about any jerseys of any kind, unless it's like a specific, awful design. The All-Star jerseys that they just wore were awfully designed. But when it comes to color schemes and that kind of stuff, I don't generally have any, strong feelings. So, I'm not one to say that I hate the jerseys or love them either way. I will say the one disclaimer is that I was so ready to get rid of the black jerseys when they did get rid of them. And I thought when they did get rid of them, everything just kind of got brighter. The stadium felt brighter and the logos felt brighter and the uniforms were brighter. And it just was more, positive, had a more positive vibe to it, whether or not they actually played well after they got rid of them. You said the jerseys are more associated with that 99-2000 era, but for me, anytime I see a picture of the Mets wearing the black jerseys in the 06, 07, 08 era pictures at Shea Stadium, the very little video that exists from that specific era on YouTube that, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to scour and find, you know, anything that I can. And some people have uploaded full games from that era, and I have pored over them because that's, you know, the reason why I love this team and this game so much is because of that era. And, you know, I was a little, you know, too young at the time to be upset about the collapse in 07 and 08, you know, for more than a day or even, you know, a couple hours. And, you know, it didn't really faze me at the time. But, you know, I just loved everything about those teams and how it got me into baseball. So to one, you know, see the excitement of the players, guys like Alonso and Stroman and Syndergaard, who have, you know, talked publicly about how excited they are to wear the black jerseys and to you know, just be able to see them on the field again is just exciting. It's an exciting thing for me to get a little bit of my childhood back. And the one thing I do want to pose to you guys is, or just little nugget to bring up, is there are four people who will be wearing the black jerseys with the Mets who have worn them in the past. And I guess the question for you guys is, who are those guys?
You mean, wait, on the current roster?
On the current,
or you mean on the like
New York Mets? With the New York Mets is the clue, I guess. People who will be wearing
with
the jerseys when they bring them back.
Now, is there going to be a ceremony? Because that's the part that I didn't like. I haven't completely uncovered what July 30th entails, but not on the actual current 25 or whatever the number is roster now. Because as far as I could tell, there would be nobody who was here in 2011.
Yeah, so they did wear them a little bit in 2012. So Jerry Familia technically was a Met in 2012, but missed them because he came up in September. But the thing I was alluding to is there are four coaches on the team who wore them in the past. It'll be
okay. So
Jeremy
before you don't have to go completely. You don't have to say everybody because I want to see if either Rich or Mike. So let's give Rich a chance first to finish. So we got Hefner out there. I did hear that.
I'm gonna say Ricky Bonus, Dave Jouse. I believe Jouse. I'm a little less sure of Bonus. I think might have been there. So Bonus, Jouse, and I'm trying to think of who the other one could be. Wasn't DeSarcina, bullpen coach, no. Base coaches, no. I that's all I've got, Jacob. I'm going with Jouse and Ricky Bonus, and I know you said four over and above Hefner, but I can't come up with another one. Am I right on Jouse and Ricky Bonus?
Yeah, so I actually totally forgot about Bonus. So I guess he would be in the same category as Hefner because Bonus first came in 2012 and they only wore it like two or three times that year. But yeah, so Bonus, Hefner, I said. So then it would be five in total. So there's two more that we'd have to knock out.
Oh, wow. Mike.
Hefner and Bonus were the only ones that I thought of, but I was thinking completely off the reservation. I was just thinking Piazza and Leiter were going to throw out the first pitch.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I would hope that they are. Jacob, who are the other two?
So the other guy who wore it they both wore it as players, would be Brian Schneider, who was with the team
forget about Brian.
08-09 era, right? Who, you know, I watched as the young one, and is now the the field coordinator, I think is his title. And then the other one that had slipped my mind when I was originally thinking of them, originally I thought it was just Hefner, Schneider, and Jouse, Jave Jouse, who's now an internet celebrity after pitching to Pete Alonso and the home run derby. So I initially thought it was those three, then I forgot the last guy that I'm going to mention, and then Rich, you brought up Bonus. But the other guy was Tony Tarasco, who was briefly a Met in, I believe, either 02 or 03, and then, and you know, wore the black jerseys at the time. He's now back as the first base coach, so I thought that was fun.
Now, Mike, I think you're the closest to, like, a Yankee who would know Yankee history. But even though I think some of you, Jacob, you might be too young, but Rich, you may know some Yankee lore. But Tony Tarasco, he was the one pointing to Jeffrey Mayer.
Jeffrey Mayer.
And then wasn't he involved in the unassisted triple play as well? When he was like, I think he may have been the one. Am I wrong about that?
You got me on that one.
Does that ring a bell?
No, it doesn't. It could be. I just don't remember.
He's most famous from, like, he was on Baltimore pointing at Jeffrey Mayer.
Right.
Okay. And so, because every time I go, hey, Tony Tarasco, I know that name. I know that there was some other place that I wanted to go, but now I'm kind of spacing. But we are closing in on. I will mention the big red ruckus. Fred McMurray was the original absent-minded professor, the inventor of flubber. How about that? Big,
hey,
red ruckus.
Sam,
in for the win. Yes,
I have one. So the guy who runs our season ticket thing, he sent me a bunch of trivia questions saying we could do this all night. We're not going to do it all night. I'll give you one example, and I think it's kind of fun. We'll do it real quick. So five people who have ever played first base for the Mets are in the Hall of Fame. Who can name any of them? Just go around real quick. Who? What names pop to mind?
Gil Hodges and Eddie Murray.
Well, Hodges isn't in the Hall of Fame.
You're right.
Murray is one.
Oh,
that's my fantasy. That's my fantasy. But Eddie Murray.
Yeah,
he should be.
Frank Thomas.
Both Frank Thomases? Not both Frank Thomases. Sorry, I couldn't know.
No.
Sorry.
These are people who have ever played first for the Mets who are in the Hall of Fame.
Richie,
I was going to say there's probably people who are not primary first basemen who probably played the position
right
at some point.
That would be correct.
Like Gary Carter and Piazza Wright probably played first at some point.
You have three. So Murray,
okay.
Carter,
okay.
Piazza, two more guys.
And not Richie Ashburn?
No, he played second. Mike, this guy's from our era. Mets got him at the very end of his career. Legend.
Joe Torre?
Well, that was what I was thinking of.
He made
yes,
the Hall of Fame
Torrey's
as
one
a manager, but he played for the Mets, and he played first base for the Mets as well.
That is correct, and we're missing one more. Mike, a legend. The Mets brought him back to New York. I just gave it away.
Willie Mays.
My guy stumped me on Torre, and I'll tell you why. I don't think of Torre as a Hall of Famer because he wasn't as a player, but he's in the Hall
right,
of Fame as a
right
manager. Yep. Good job, guys.
That's
beautiful. You have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and before we get to our final word, I'm just going to, for one, take one more look. I think we covered everything, Mike. Mike, do you have anything left?
No, I'm just going to jump out with Gil Hodges again. Let's get him in the Hall of Fame. Now his name is out there.
We should really quickly talk about it. I will say this, and I'll start. And, yes, we should get Gil Hodges into the Hall of Fame. But, Rich, you know, we thought this COVID thing was behind us, and here we come, you know, Yankees Red Sox postponed tonight.
It's a very stark reminder that the pandemic isn't over for all of us, and, you know, vaccinated or not, you know, we need to be careful. And but the other stark reminder is, you know, there hasn't been a COVID impact in baseball in terms of games since the middle of April. Yes, the Mets had it in early April, but there was an impact in the middle of April. I believe it was the A's and the White Sox. I could be wrong, but it was West Coast teams. And we have to be careful, guys, because, you know, we don't, with this Delta variant going around, and, you know, we see it with the Yankees. Well, the Mets are having such a magical run here, you know, being in first place with playing with a AAA roster for a month. I don't want to see this thing blow up. I don't. And it's a reminder that while that maybe isn't likely, who knows what's going to happen a month from now? I mean, are we going to start seeing series and games postponed? And are we going to be in the same situation as last year where they're arguing about, you know, do we want to play the World Series in November? This whole it's been silent for 3 months, and that was great, but it's back. Let's hope it's isolated with the Yankees, doesn't go any farther than that, but it's something that it could impact the rest of the season. There's no denying that, and we have to hope it doesn't.
Mike, we thought we were out of the woodwork, but here we are.
That's it. I'm good. I got everything off my chest. No. I don't want to extend. Go ahead.
Jacob, are you worried that this could be, you know, the snowball?
At this point, no. I mean, I'm certainly not, you know, excited by what just happened today with the Yankees, and especially considering with the All-Star break, with everyone going back home to their various residences, and you know, I'm sure a lot of them are, you know. There are players who are not vaccinated who are probably around people who were not vaccinated, and, you know, just whatever. So it's certainly possible that we start seeing some more of these as players return from the break, and especially with the people who were at the All-Star game, you know, with it looking like it was, you know, Aaron Judge picking something up there. So I hope it's not. I'm not concerned right now that it will be, but you know, I mean, it's just kind of have to cross your fingers the rest of the season that the Mets are going to be safe from it, especially considering it's not looking like they're going to reach the vaccination threshold.
Yeah, it's just a reminder that we all got to stay safe out there, you know, stay alert, and just understand that this stuff hasn't completely gone away, and take advantage of the things like hand sanitizer everywhere now that is there for you that wasn't there before. You know, that's really all I can say on the matter. You know, just hopefully this like you said, does not rear its ugly head when it comes to the Mets, but just in general, in terms of all of baseball, we got really used to everything kind of feeling semi-normal there. So, yeah, everybody, like, just keep your head on a swivel, as they say. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, as always, for listening to the Metsian Podcast. And before we get to our final word, I just want to pass it over to Jacob first to start with your final word. But before you get to that, please, shameless plug for everybody, tell everyone out there where they can find you.
Yeah, I mean, just once again, thanks to all three of you for having me on once again. You know, I'm on Twitter at Jacob_Resnick, R-E-S-N-I-C-K. Things are going well in the Twitter world right now. So I'm looking forward to continuing to have all the lovely discussions that I have with the Mets fans out there. You know, just my last word, don't know if I was prepared to bring this up to bring something up, but I guess I'll just say that I'm just really excited for the rest of the year, specifically thinking about the last time the Mets made a run in the postseason in 2015, and I was a sophomore in high school at the time. and just how exciting everything was. You know, it was just so much fun to go into school every day and see my fellow Mets fan friends and talk about everything that was going on, and just the vibe in the city was fantastic. You know, I'd high-five random people on the street with Mets gear on, which I noticed a lot more of at the time. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to potentially having that again. And just the fact that I go to school in Connecticut with just an obscene amount of Boston Red Sox fans, a lot of Yankees fans, and not that many Mets fans, would just make it a lot sweeter. So, you know, we talked about it, but fingers crossed that they're able to hold on to the division lead, make a run, and so it's going to be exciting for sure. So, yeah, just, you know, thank you guys again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you again, Jacob, and enjoy the summer before your senior year at Quinnipiac. That should be exciting for sure, man. I'm going to pass it first to Mike for his last word.
Very simply, let's go Mets. I'm looking forward to the second half. That's it.
Thank you, Mike. I just want to say I'm going to pass it on to Rich to take us out, because I like the idea that Mike has started, the tradition that Mike has started of the host passing it on to one of the esteemed co-conspirators of this podcast. And my final word I would have to say is excitement. I think this is a great opportunity. Everything that the Mets have shown me so far, every time that the pessimistic Mets fan out there that just has literally gone onto Twitter only to always talk about the next time the Mets are going to blow it like 2007. Every time I've seen that happen, where the Mets are just, the Nationals were a little too close for comfort. Everybody, like some of these pessimistic Mets fans thought that the Mets were going to be out of first place by the All-Star break. Here we are. We lost that last game in a terrible fashion, but we're still in first place, and we're not even close to out of it necessarily. We still at least have that half a game of a general three-game series that could potentially wipe it out. So every time that the Mets look like they're going to give an inch, they take a mile. And that's what I love about this 2021 team right now. I am excited to see what they have, and I'm excited to see their determination that you can clearly see within this group of fellows. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it on to Rich Spirago. And please, Rich, give a shameless plug, if you will. Tell everybody where they can find you.
All right. Well, on Twitter, it's at MetFanRich, at CTMetsFan, and also on Metsmerized Online. So thank you, Sam, for that. And my final word would be I'm excited, because guys, the Mets haven't been buyers at the deadline, like firm buyers, since 2016. And when they brought in Jay Bruce. So we know they're going to be buyers. They'll go out and they'll likely bring in a player or two. And that is always exciting to me. The deadline to me, as we lead up to the deadline, is very exciting to see what positions they try to shore up, who are they willing to trade, what kind of roster manipulations, you have all that. And then, of course, you have 2.5 months of essentially a pennant drive here. You know, they haven't locked this thing up by any stretch of the imagination, so it's going to be – they're going to have to play hard. It's going to be a race. It's going to be fun. The schedule will be daunting, like we talked about with the Giants and Dodgers, but I don't think any more daunting than it was with 33 games in 31 days. So there's all of that to overcome, and we'll see who the last team standing is in the division on October 3rd. I think it will be the Mets, but we'll see. So I'm excited. And with that said, we want to thank everyone for listening to the Metsian podcast. We want to especially thank Jacob Resnick, as noted before, for joining us. We'll have him back on real soon. And Sam, I'll throw it back to you, because as we know, there's really only one way to end these podcasts. And how is that?
Let's go Mets. Let's go, Mets. Let's go, Mets. First place team, everybody. Let's handle this. Let's hold on. Let's continue. Let's push forward. Take care, everybody. Thanks again, Jacob. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Rich.
Have a great night.
Good night, Metsville.